Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Often when we talk about tough issues in this country, race and slavery, gender inequality, and the like, we deal in absolutes, when acknowledging the gray area would do a world of good. That's one reason why Steve Inskeep's new book is so compelling. Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and A Great American Land Grab doesn't deal in heroes and villains, although there are plenty of both. Instead, it's a close examination of the decades of often tortured decisions on both sides that led up to the Trail of Tears. Indeed, reflecting the competing laws and realities of the time, the book's first few pages include the concurrent divergent maps of the same areas, what would become the American South. In Inskeep's telling, how we got there is not a happy tale. Steve Inskeep is heard each morning on these airwaves as the host of NPR's Morning Edition, and it's my pleasure to welcome him to the Roundtable.
Hey, it's an honor to be here, Ian.
How come you wanted to put Andrew Jackson and John Ross sort of in conversation with each other in this book?
You hit on it in that fine introduction, and thank you very much for that. It's a chance to show, a chance for me anyway, to show and to explore two men, neither of them perfect, fighting it out over real estate, as it turns out, in a democracy, in our democracy, which was just taking shape at that time in the early 1800s. It was democracy that drew me there to begin with. It was my day job covering politics here in Washington and across the country, and feeling a few years ago that things were really drifting in a bad way, and trying to find out how we got here. That drove me back to the beginnings of our modern democracy, which took shape at that time, and in focusing on these two really amazing guys, I felt that I was able to get a better sense of things.
It's kind of amazing because they had shared the battlefield together early in the story, but I'm hoping you can set the stage for, you know, we're talking, I guess, 1812, 1813, 1814, 1815, 1816, what each man expected and hoped for his cause.
Well, you're describing the War of 1812, when Andrew Jackson, who had been a frontier politician in Tennessee was the frontier then, and had been a militia general, was elevated into the federal service. His job was to fight the British and ultimately to fight Indian nations that were effectively, at least, on the same side as the British in the War of 1812. He was fighting in this way. John Ross joined that army because he was part of something called the Cherokee Regiment. They're battling in what is now the American South. It was then called the American Southwest. The Cherokees were there. The Cherokee Nation was there. It was on one map, as you said, part of the United States, won from Britain at the end of the Revolutionary War and now being defended by the United States. But in legal reality, and on the other map, what I call the Indian map, it was a series of Indian nations, or a lot of the territory there was. Cherokees had an independent nation, but were also aware they were being overwhelmed by this wave of white settlement. They had not totally resisted this. In fact, they'd tried to buy in and be part of this new world that was being created. They changed their culture and their economy and many other things. And so they'd signed up for Andrew Jackson's army to defend the United States. Jackson and Ross begin on the same side in this conflict, but from the very beginning, there are signs that they're not going to be on the same side very long.
Who recognized that first?
I think it must have been John Ross. We have letters from both of these men, hundreds of letters in the case of Ross, and perhaps thousands of letters. In fact, certainly thousands of letters in the case of Andrew Jackson. They're both so different and so expressive in their letters. And you see Jackson very early on, even in 1814, shortly after the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, in which both men fought, Jackson organized a peace conference with the Creek Nation. There was a rebellious faction of Creeks who had gone against the United States. They'd been crushed by Jackson and Ross at Horseshoe Bend and the Cherokees at Horseshoe Bend. And then there was a peace conference. The rebels, the Creek rebels, didn't show up for the most part. The Creek allies of the United States showed up. So Jackson was there with his friends, and he starts demanding concessions of land, immense concessions of land, from his friends. And it becomes evident then that even allies of Andrew Jackson are not going to be immune from his wrath if they have something that he wants. And what he really wanted was real estate. Within a couple of years after that, Ian, we find John Ross in Washington as a rising Cherokee politician. He has affirmed his ties to the Cherokee Nation. He was a man of mixed race. He could conceivably have gone another way. He affirmed his ties to the Cherokees, and he was battling by 1816 to prevent Andrew Jackson from grabbing Cherokee land.
Now, for Jackson, and certainly this would come more into play once he took over the White House, was the move into the American South, what we now recognize as the American South, a political instinct, or was it more that, you know, there was a chance to profit from these land deeds and expand for himself, for his own wealth?
First, I love that you use the word instinct, because sometimes you sense that Jackson is a man who moved by instinct. I think that he was a really strategic and far-seeing man. He couldn't always necessarily express the strategy that was on his mind, but he would move in really powerful and strategic ways. And there was something very big afoot, which you also allude to, the desire for real estate. When people think of Andrew Jackson winning wars against Indians or Native Americans in that part of the country and getting land from them, people think about it a lot of different ways, making way in a generic sense for white settlement or securing the borders of the United States. It absolutely was those things. And there were a lot of poor white farmers who moved into places like the emerging state of Alabama or Mississippi and tried to make a living for themselves and always remembered Andrew Jackson's role in it. But something bigger and more entrepreneurial, if you will, was going on, and that is that white slave owners were transporting slaves by the thousands, hundreds of thousands, eventually even millions, into this region that we now call the Deep South, and setting up cotton plantations that were immensely valuable. And what I lay out in this book that I think has not been exposed quite so fully before is that Jackson himself and his close friends personally profited by obtaining tens of thousands of acres of choice former Cherokee land in the Tennessee Valley. So Jackson was a public official arranging to get this land for the United States. And then while he was still a public official, he was figuring out ways to use inside information to purchase key plots of land with his friends and profit immensely from it.
We're speaking with Steve Inskeep, the host of NPR's Morning Edition. He's also the author of a new book called Jackson Land. I want to touch on the ways that the conflict in your book foreshadows the American Civil War. A huge part of the fight between the Cherokees and other tribes and the federal government came down to states' rights ultimately, right?
Oh, absolutely. You had states, especially the state of Georgia, saying, we have the right to control our land. We have the right to expel Indians from this land that we want. We have the right to govern this land. In fact, as far back as 1802, the Georgians had gotten the federal government to sign a compact more or less saying this. The federal government was supposed to regulate affairs with Indian tribes or Indian nations. The federal government was in charge by law, going back to George Washington. But the state of Georgia got the federal government to undertake to get rid of all of the Indians on what was described as Georgia's territory. It hadn't even been surveyed or marked in many cases, but they imagined it on a map and they said it needed to be cleared of Indians. And even though the federal government only promised to do this when it could be peaceably done on reasonable terms, in other words, they were supposed to negotiate to buy land from Indians, even though the federal government only made this very limited promise, Georgia very quickly, as the years went on, said no, this was a sacred obligation, and it was defying states' rights that the federal government was failing to get rid of the Indians. And you have a lot of increasing anger and rancor and also political paranoia over states' rights and the state versus the federal government that went on throughout the early 19th century. One president after another was pushed around by Georgia, and finally came Andrew Jackson, who was worried about Georgia exploding, but also tended to agree with them and was happy to give them everything they wanted.
A big part of your book deals with the power of the press. Eventually, the Cherokees were able to get their own newspaper up and running and were able to kind of reach their constituents, but also a much wider audience. But there is a very sad moment in the book where I believe it was the kind of lead publisher and journalist behind the Phoenix saying that, you know, American knows what our argument is by now, and they're just not listening.
Oh, yeah. And I appreciate that you caught that line. As a journalist, it caught me. Perhaps that's why it caught your attention. Elias Boudinot, what a fascinating guy. He was in his 20s when he started being the editor of this newspaper, which published articles in Cherokee. So it was a cultural advancement, but also published articles in English that could be spread across the United States. It was a political advancement. Yeah, he had succeeded about as well as any journalist of a small newspaper in what was effectively rural Georgia could ever hope to succeed. The paper was known across the country. It was even read by a few people in Europe. It got the word out, and it had allies in other papers that reprinted the articles, but he was frustrated in the end. He felt the public was well-informed, and they didn't care. And that is one of the many moments that makes me think of our democracy today. Not that things are always so frustrating. Certainly when the media gets on something, or even a million people on Twitter get on something, they can demand action, and sometimes things can change. But oftentimes also people feel that a lot of information is out there and it's ignored and the world goes on as it is. You can really relate to this guy's frustration, or I can as a journalist and as a citizen anyway. Although, honestly, I think he was a little bit wrong. He wrote these articles and they survive, and you can go, I have gone, to the Library of Congress, and you can find actual issues of the Cherokee Phoenix from 1828 or 1829 or 30 or 31, and you can read the Cherokee perspective of things. Not an idea of Cherokees as translated through white observers of the time. You can actually read what Cherokees were thinking, and it's their own words composed in their own way, their own perspectives, their own arguments, and it was really helpful and enlightening to me. It allowed me to listen and learn and get to know people from another time.
Then is now the Supreme Court loomed as a final, possibly, arbiter. And Justice Marshall plays a huge role, effectively taking the side of the Cherokees, even though ultimately he wasn't able to protect them in the end.
Yeah, just the idea that John Marshall was around in the 1830s surprised me. I think of him as a little bit earlier in the century, and he was. He was just there for decades and decades and decades. And I discovered a story that it's not the first time it's been told, I don't think, but I'm not sure it's been told exactly this way. I discovered that John Marshall took an interest in the Cherokee cause and played a role in a way that some people might consider unethical today. He played a role in arranging for the Cherokees to bring a case before the Supreme Court. He sent word that he would listen favorably if such a case were brought before the Supreme Court. And the Cherokees sued once, saying the state of Georgia had no right to mess with them, and Marshall didn't like the legal reasoning, and so he sent the case away. He rejected it. But then they sued again. Georgia had imprisoned a couple of missionaries, white missionaries, who worked among the Cherokees. Georgia didn't like that they were there without a permit and that they were effectively supporting the Cherokee cause, so they were thrown in prison. The case was to free them. John Marshall ruled in favor of the Cherokees. He said that the missionaries had to be freed, and not only that, the Cherokees had the right to govern their own land. It's a really amazing ruling, which you can find it in the book, or honestly, you can go on Google and do a little bit of searching, 5 minutes of searching, I believe, and find John Marshall's entire ruling from Worcester versus Georgia in 1832. It's a pretty amazing read, a pretty amazing summary of United States and Native American history in the early parts of the century. But in the end, it came to nothing. Jackson found ways around the ruling. It was effectively ignored, and nothing whatever happened except that Cherokees celebrated for a moment and then realized that even when they won, they lost.
Mm-hmm. And as the story winds up, Andrew Jackson is out of the White House. He's back at the Hermitage, and his successor, Martin Van Buren, is pressing forward with the removal, and even till the very last minute, John Ross is still wheeling and dealing.
Yeah, this is the Trail of Tears, but it's a part of the Trail of Tears I didn't learn. I learned about the Trail of Tears, I think, in junior high school. There was a page or a unit on it or something, and it stuck with me. Maybe you did too, and maybe it stuck with you, the stories of soldiers coming and beating on the doors, the cabin doors of Cherokees, and forcing them to go out on the road and start west. And I discovered that it all happened in a different way than I'd ever thought, and that it almost came out differently. Yeah, John Ross negotiated until the last moment, trying to get better terms, actually saying, okay, we will leave voluntarily, but you've got to improve the terms under which you force us to do this. And the federal government was so worried about how this would look, this rousting out of people out of cabins, they actually negotiated with him, but the negotiations went on a little too long. It's really, to me, an amazing political story that I'd never heard before.
So the question for me is, having read the book and learned plenty from it, and certainly had strong emotions about it, in 2015, you know, what do you hope the lesson is? And is there anything modern day Americans can be doing, should be doing, when they confront this history?
First, I want people to know it. And this is what people in Cherokee, North Carolina told me. In the western tip of North Carolina, there are Cherokees whose ancestors managed to evade removal and have been there ever since. And one of them said to me, the past is past. Everyone involved is dead. We don't even want our land back, but we want the story to be told. And I want the story to be told. I also want the story to be told from Jackson's perspective as well. I want the full story to be told because I think it's important to our country and important to democracy. This story, exploring it, has made me think differently, and I hope more deeply. Other people will say if it's true, but I hope more deeply about democracy and what it means and how it works. It's imperfect people going at each other through the democratic system, often with hideous results, but we would like to hope learning from past mistakes and getting a little better over time. The people in the early 19th century were dealing with a very diverse country, more diverse than we may realize at first glance today. Different kinds of people, different races, different cultures, trying to figure out how to mesh together and still remain, and actually at that time, and become one country. And here we are a couple of centuries later, and we have a far more diverse country with people from all over the world, or their ancestors are all over the world, and we're wrestling with that same question. How do we work out our differences, respect everybody's rights, and make sure that we're still one country? The question is still alive. And when I read the letters from almost 200 years ago, I find people coming up with some of the same solutions or attempted solutions, using some of the same kinds of phrases, employing the same kinds of politics. And I see them working through the problem then. And I just hope that we can learn and be a little better at working through it now.
Last question. You do interviews with a lot of people for a living on Morning Edition. You talk to a lot of authors who are on book tours and radio tours and so on. And I wonder, when you're on the other side of that, does that influence the way you do your day job when you get back to it?
Oh, goodness. Well, now that I've been through this great interview, it's going to totally change everything.
Stop it.
No, it is a different experience. It's fun. In either case, though, I'm trying to learn as I go. And trying to make sure that I only say what I know and qualify what I know. That's true whether I'm asking questions or answering them. It's been really a really rewarding time to be talking a little bit about this book because I feel so strongly about it and been working on the story for so long. But in the end, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm a little more comfortable asking the questions and listening and learning than answering them.
Aren't we all? Well, Steve Inskeep is the author of Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and A Great American Land Grab. And you can hear him on this station each morning at 5 a.m. on Morning Edition. Steve Inskeep, just an absolute pleasure to read the book and then have a chance to ask you about it. Thank you so much.
Glad to be on this station. Thank you.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.